This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, January 17th of 2023. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we hear about a new state office tasked with tracking gun violence across Colorado as a public health issue. We'll hear from the director. H2O Radio reports on a royal pain, how king tides in California reveal a troubling future. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth. Today, the KGNU Science Show shares pros and cons about the new drug for Alzheimer's disease, which doesn't cure dementia, but does appear to slow it down. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for headlines with KGNU's John Kellen.
Governor Jared Polis will deliver his fifth State of the State address to a joint session of lawmakers in Denver this morning. The governor began his second term last week following re-election in November. His announced second-term priorities include more affordable housing in the state, making Colorado 100% renewable energy powered by 2040, and reducing crime. Activists say they'll gather at the Capitol to show their opposition to the Polis administration's approval of drilling permits in residential areas in spite of the passage of a reform bill 4 years ago. Government offices and schools were closed Monday in observance of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Commemorative events took place throughout the area and emphasized the ongoing need for social justice. Speakers and singers appeared at a packed Modus Theater at the Dairy Center in Boulder, including CU Professor Raylan Rabaka and The Reminders. Professor Rabaka also appeared at an event in Longmont, urging listeners to continue to work toward the multiracial democracy advanced by Dr. King, one that welcomes society's most marginalized people. In Denver, thousands turned out for the 38th Annual March and Parade, or Marade as it's known, which began at the King Memorial in City Park. Its theme was strength through justice, and its speakers also stressed the need for unity. At the time of his assassination in 1968, Dr. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, in support of striking sanitation workers. Decades later, unionizing the workforce remains a key issue for many. In Boulder tomorrow, Starbucks employees will vote on unionization. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
If the unionization vote, scheduled for the Broadway and Baseline Starbucks tomorrow, is successful, they would become the first union Starbucks in Boulder and the ninth location in the state to join Starbucks Workers United. They would also be joining the more than 270 unionized locations of the 9,000 Starbucks U.S. stores that have voted to unionize since late last year. NPR reports that Starbucks and the union have begun contract talks in about 50 stores, but no agreements have been reached. Starbucks opposes the unionization effort, saying the company functions better when it works directly with employees. But the company said last November that it respects employees' lawful right to protest. Tomorrow's vote in Boulder will be conducted at the store from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., with results immediately tallied and announced at 5 p.m. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
The number of migrants arriving in Denver has dropped in recent days. The city has announced it will deactivate one of its emergency shelters and reopen the recreation center it houses. More than 4,200 migrants from Latin America have arrived in Denver since early December, and city officials have warned the demand was straining emergency housing services. Democrats in Colorado's House District 12, which includes Lafayette, Louisville, Niwot, and Superior, will meet next week to choose someone to fill a seat vacated by Tracy Burnett. KGNU's Alyssa Palazzo has more.
Tracy Burnett resigned her District 12 seat in the Colorado House of Representatives last week, before the House was to convene for the first time in 2023. Boulder County District Attorney's Office pressed charges against Burnett in November, alleging she had forged documents falsely claiming she lived in District 12. Investigators reported the search in her District 12 apartment turned up, quote, mostly cobwebs. The meeting on January 28th will include district officers, precinct committee, and support members, and any General Assembly member who lives in House District 12. No state senator currently lives in HD 12. Louisville City Council member Kyle Brown is the latest to add his name to those vying to replace Burnett. Brown says his progressive agenda makes him the right person for the job. Former Congressman David Skaggs and Boulder Valley School District Board of Education member Kitty Sargent have also announced their candidacy for the District 12 seat. For KGNU, I'm Alyssa Palazzo.
State wildlife officials say the avian flu is killing wild birds in unprecedented numbers. An official with the Rocky Mountain Raptor Program told the Fort Collins Coloradoan that the center has been getting calls about dead geese on Sheldon Lake and other water bodies in the Fort Collins area. Mary Wood, a wildlife health program supervisor with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife, says the agency has confirmed the avian influenza virus in Canadian geese in Larimer County. It had previously been found in flocks of chickens and turkeys. According to the Coloradoan, many park users are seeing dead geese in varying degrees of decay. People are being advised to avoid touching them or picking them up and to keep their pets away from them. In today's weather, a winter storm warning is in effect throughout the area beginning tonight. Light snowfall this afternoon is expected to get heavier as the evening goes on, with 5 to 9 inches possible. High temperatures today around 36 degrees with overnight lows at 25. For KGNU, I'm John Kellen.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Colorado has been the scene of several notorious mass shootings, but suicides are by far the leading cause of gun deaths here. In 2021, Colorado voters approved the creation of a new office within the state's Department of Public Health and Environment to tackle the issue of gun violence. They're partnering with the School of Public Health to create an information bank that tracks and studies gun violence across the state. KGNU's Alexis Kenyon spoke with Jonathan McMillan, director of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, as well as Colorado's chief medical officer, Dr. Eric France, to learn about the new state efforts to address Colorado's growing gun violence epidemic.
Director McMillan, I'll start with you. Entity you lead, the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, is still relatively new. What is its mission?
Oh, so the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, as you mentioned, is relatively new. And the main purpose of the office is to research and to promote effective ways of reducing and preventing gun violence in Colorado using a public health approach.
I'm always so surprised to see how little research there is about gun violence. You would think it would be something that would be easy to track and, you know, have readily available. But there have been attempts to study gun violence as a public health issue at the federal level, but legislators have been unable to allocate CDC funding for the research. Is studying this at the state level a way of being able to create a body of research? And how many other states are doing this?
Great question. And I think you really keyed in on one of the challenges of implementing widespread strategies and interventions into gun violence prevention immediately is that the lack of funding and the lack of research has existed up to this point because of the Dickey Amendment, which I think came into effect in 1993, which limited the amount of federal funds that could be allocated not only across the nation, but even at the state level. So to answer your question, I think more specifically with the resource bank, this is going to be, in my eyes, a game changer because it will be a repository of data, of best practices and the culmination of research, both locally and from the national perspective on what effective strategies exist around gun violence prevention, and it'll be housed in one space. I kind of call it the Google of all things gun violence prevention here in Colorado. Additionally, that the resource bank will be a clearinghouse for information and resources that exist outside of just data. Hopefully a place where people can share what's working for them in their local communities and be able to work and build some collaborations to scale some of those efforts up. And also a place where people can go to identify funding sources for continued research or continued projects. So that's the hope, in that Colorado will be a leader nationally in building this model of sharing information easily, making it easily accessible, and being able to help amplify the work that's happening around gun violence prevention from this public health approach.
So Colorado had 13 mass shootings last year with 80 people killed. Both of those are record setting, but that's not even, you know, the bulk of people who died because of gun violence. Most of them are suicide, and then there's homicide at 25% of gun deaths after that. And it just feels like gun violence is just getting worse every day. And it's overwhelming because we're talking about it all the time, and we're talking about mental health, and then we're fighting about gun rights. And meanwhile, just like more and more people are dying of gun violence, and there are more and more guns. I mean, what is an evidence-based solution to gun violence other than, you know, not having guns, which doesn't seem like it's really even an option because of such passionate, you know, ideologies on both sides?
You know, that's a great observation, Alexis. And as a person who comes from a community that's traditionally been impacted heavily by gun violence, this is something that I'm very passionate about, and why I was driven to pursue this work. It's, again, not to sound repetitive, but from a public health approach and looking at the data and looking what are some of the effective strategies. And one of the strategies that has shown to be the most effective really falls into what some would call responsible gun ownership practices and safe and secure storage. One of the easiest and simplest ways that a gun owner can reduce the likelihood of gun violence happening is by securing their firearm safely with, say, a gun or a trigger lock or a gun safe, or also making sure that it's stored and unloaded. As oftentimes, say in the example of suicide prevention, if a person is having suicidal ideations, the research demonstrates that the longer that it takes for a person to have access to a means to complete that suicide, the less likely that they're going to go through with it. And if a firearm is in play, if that firearm is safely secured, it's much less likely that they're going to be able to use that weapon to complete the ideation. That being said, we can also, safe and secure storage is a effective way to make sure that firearms are not accessible to criminals or those who should not get a hold of them in case a firearm is lost or stolen, because it's safely secured, unloaded, and difficult to access if you're not the proper owner.
I interviewed a gun researcher one time a while ago, and he said something that stuck with me about how when you buy a gun, it's not just you that you're putting at risk. It's your children and their children and everyone in your house. Whether you bought the gun or not, they all have increased risk of dying by suicide by 100%. I mean, I don't think that when people buy guns, they think about how this gun can have a life outside of their own ownership.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think I'll defer to Dr. France. I know that you have recently had a question about an inherited firearm. Isn't that correct?
Well, I'd say in general that first, that guns are common in the United States. 37% of the adults of Colorado estimated claim they have a gun in their home. That's about 1.7 million Coloradans. I'm a hunter. I have guns in my home, and I need to be sure that I keep them stored safely. As a gun owner, we all have to have the responsibility, the personal responsibility of understanding how to store our guns safely, and have plans should there be a need for the guns to be removed for the safety of the gun owner or other family members. And so guns are here. And so just like there are risks of living in Colorado because we live a mile high, we're getting more sun than in other parts of the world, we have a culture where owning guns is common and used for many reasons, for personal safety, for sports. And so our job is to educate gun owners and households to be sure they understand how they can minimize risks with that. So I think there's growing information about what kinds of policies might be effective at reducing and preventing gun violence, but it's still in the early days in some ways.
Well, I mean, yes and no. You mentioned that guns are often used for personal safety, and I think the research that we do have makes it very clear that people who own guns are not safer. In fact, they're more likely to get shot by something like 500% more likely to be shot with a firearm if you own a gun. And that doesn't even account for the increased likelihood of suicide, which is the most common source of gun violence. And we have numbers on that.
Yes, I think, you know, in the United States, where we're allowed to own guns, the reason people buy guns is predominantly for personal safety. And we know that having a gun in your home, there's more likely that the gun might harm somebody in the family than to be used for protection. The actual risk of needing to use your gun to protect you is low, and the possibility of somebody being hurt or killed by the gun in your home is higher than the probability of you using it to defend yourself.
I've been speaking with Dr. Eric France, the Chief Medical Officer for Colorado's Department of Health and Environment, and Dr. Jonathan McMillan, the Director of CDPHE's new Gun Violence Prevention Office. They are working together with the Colorado School of Public Health to create a gun violence resource bank that tracks and studies gun violence across Colorado. Dr. France and Director McMillan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Alexis. Have a good day.
Thank you.
For KGNU, I'm Alexis Kenyon.
California has been inundated with heavy rain in recent weeks as atmospheric rivers from the Pacific Ocean unleash moisture. But within a few decades, there could be flooding in coastal communities, even on dry, sunny days, as sea levels rise. How much? The king tides offer a worrying preview. H2O Radio's Franny Halperin reports.
In the days before Christmas in Southern California, like many places around the world, holiday music populated the airwaves and shopping malls, including carols of three kings who were guided by a star toward Bethlehem. But this morning, standing along the shore in Oceanside, north of San Diego, two different kings arrived before Christmas, the King Tides, and they too offered guidance, a preview of how climate change will change California in the coming decades.
We're at the intersection of the Strand and Wisconsin Street in Oceanside, California, and it's quite a spectacle out here.
That's Mitch Silverstein with the Surfrider Foundation, an organization dedicated to protecting the world's oceans and beaches. I'm standing with him and about 40 other people, all watching, taking pictures, and some getting soaked as waves fueled by the exceptionally high king tides crash onto the street.
So today is day two of the 2022 king tides. It's about a 7-foot high tide, and there's a bit of swell, not a lot, but, you know, 3 to 4 foot waves.
The Oceanside Strand is a paved single lane road right up against the shore, with massive boulders and a seawall on one side and the patios of expensive homes on the other. There's no beach here, the kind for which Southern California is famous. The shore was long ago robbed of its sand by coastal development. While this sunny day is a festive opportunity for many, for Mitch, it's a chance to raise awareness about the serious threats posed by sea level rise.
Oceanside is very afflicted with beach erosion and beach loss, and you don't really have sand on the beaches anymore, and you don't have walkable beaches even at normal high tides. So to see it at a king high tide, this kind of gives us a real good visualization of what high and normal high tide is going to look like with 1 to 2 feet of sea level rise.
Surfrider has asked its members to video the king tides so they can share them with cities who might be thinking of permitting more development along the shore, explaining that the high water we see today could be every day a few decades from now. some people might need more convincing than others, since California hasn't seen the kind of sea level rise troubles the East Coast has. But climate experts like Patrick Barnard with the USGS say it's coming.
On the West Coast, yeah, we've been spared from this. The prevailing wind conditions in the last several decades are keeping cooler waters along the coast, and that's suppressing sea level rise.
He says as glaciers and polar ice melt, sea level rise in California will not only catch up, it will likely surpass the global average.
Yeah, it will definitely accelerate. There's just so much momentum and heat in the ocean and the atmosphere, and you know, we're going to get at least 2 feet of sea level rise from now to the end of the century as a minimum, and it could be higher depending on our emissions trajectory.
Some projections say the ocean could rise 6 or even 7 feet. So how to prepare? Current solutions range from continuously adding sand to beaches to building seawalls and revetments.
So, you know, seawalls and revetments are, you know, fairly good at protecting property behind them, but they kill beaches. They tend to accelerate erosion at the foot of them and remove sand that gets transported offshore and down coast. And we've found in Southern California that as many as 2/3 of those beaches are going to lose sand. They're going to run out of sand and they're going to be gone because there's no place for those beaches to move.
If beaches weren't boxed in by buildings, roads, and infrastructure, they would naturally migrate inland and protect the coast from the impacts of sea level rise. But they are literally caught between a rock and a hard place.
There's been a big push for nature-based solutions now, so living shorelines, you know, vegetated dunes to help protect people and property from rising seas and storms. And then there's the other end of that spectrum, which is some form of managed retreat, which is a very, very bad word in the coastal community.
Even though relocating beachfront property inland and installing living shorelines can better absorb wave erosion, not to mention provide habitat for coastal wildlife, attend any public meeting and you'll quickly find talk like that is a non-starter.
You know, nobody wants to hear that. It's a very emotional issue, as we can all, I think, empathize with that. How is you as a homeowner, maybe it's your childhood home, how could you face having to leave that property and leave that sense of place and culture? And so it's a big challenge, but in some cases, that's probably the best response.
Mitch and the Surfrider Foundation say there's still a chance to have sandy beaches, even in Oceanside, if action is taken soon.
Long term, these houses are toast. That's how I feel long term. They're going to move sooner or later, and the value is going to go down sooner or later because insurance companies are going to stop insuring these homes. Like, it's only going to go downhill. So, I mean, look at this street being totally soaked right now. The cities really have two choices, you know, do nothing and wait till it's really an emergency and it's probably going to be even more expensive to deal with this.
Or heed the warning of the king tides to save California's coastline now or risk paying a princely sum later. In Oceanside, California for H2O Radio, I'm Franny Halperin.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and what's on the minds of listeners this week.
Yes, I want to comment on the generally excellent program you just ran about Suncor. I'd like to make a couple of corrections, at least to my understanding. Number one, even though Suncor is shut down, they're still emitting. And the Cozy Bondo monitoring program clearly indicates that. Number two, for some reason, nobody wants to pay any attention to SB 181, which was passed in the state in 2019. It absolutely requires for oil and gas to operate, it must protect public health and well-being. There is no way that anyone can argue that Suncor is protective of public health and safety. So you don't need another study. You need the data that demonstrates how damaging it is, because there are plenty of studies out there showing that oil and gas is damaging the public health. Thirdly, I think that you should talk to the Cultivando people about what they're learning from their monitoring program. They've been doing it now for 6 or 7 months, and I think you'll be amazed at just how devastating Suncor or that pollution in that area, you've got two major petroleum storage facilities there too, really impact that community. Thank you.
Good afternoon, folks. This is Linda. I'm wondering how come the music I most long to hear, like First Catch at 5:30 a.m., Restless Morning, Sleepless Nights, These never have permalinks and play links. Who can appreciate these potential gems if one is fast asleep? So please consider adding that feature. I would greatly appreciate it. Thanks.
A quick note for that last caller, KGNU's music shows are available in a streaming format at afterfm.com. You can find archives of the various shows at the toolbar at the top of the page. If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message on our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. Please keep it concise and germane. That's it for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to John Kellen, Steve Miller, Alyssa Palazzo, Alexis Kenyon, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host and producer, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.